In Revelation 11, we have multiple things being described. We have, for example, at the beginning of the chapter, God's people taking the gospel throughout the world. And John says there would come a time when it would look like the church was stamped out. Then he says there would come a time when the church would be revived. And then we got down to Revelation chapter 11, verse 12, where John actually takes us up to the end of time. He says, and they heard, that would be God's people, the church, they heard a great voice from heaven saying unto them, come up hither. And, looking across the page, they went up into heaven in a cloud, and their enemies beheld them. Now we've said we have seven seals, and then after the seven seals we have seven trumpets, and then after the seven trumpets we have seven plagues. With the first six seals, with the first six trumpets, and with the first six plagues, we have various items that deal with the Christian era. And when we come to the sixth seal, the sixth trumpet, and the sixth plague, we have events that are leading up to, they take us to the time of the second coming. And this is, of course, the sixth one that we're dealing with here. So John, as he talks about this time period, we're coming right up to the end. Here in verse 12, they've heard the great voice from heaven. It's, you know, now time for the end of time to come. Come up hither. And then, of course, you have not only the righteous there at the end of time, but you have God's enemies as well. Verse 13, thinking about, you know, this end of time period, if you will, right when it's time for the Lord to come, he does return and so forth. And in that hour, that would be, you know, at the time of the Lord's coming, there was a great earthquake, and the tenth part of the city fell. And there were killed in the earthquake 7,000 persons, and the rest were affrighted, and they gave glory to the God of heaven. Now, we've identified the time period as time for the Lord to come back. So at that time, at that hour, bringing us right to the end of the sixth trumpet and right towards the seventh, which we'll read about soon, you have these people, verses 7 through 9, that have persecuted God's people. And they've persecuted God's people to the point where it looks like the church has ceased to exist. And John said the day of reckoning, the time to punish these people has come. And he describes the punishment in some pretty vivid terms. He compares it, first of all, to what? It's like a great earthquake. Now, a few of us have been in a place where we've had an earthquake before. I don't know anybody ever been through a great earthquake. Well, if you think about the description here, though, how great is the quake? What happens? All right, there's a lot of shaking going on. Specifically? All right, we've got a city that suffers terribly, and we've got thousands of people die. You know, they die. So when John talks about a quake, he uses the comparison, or he uses the description, it's a great earthquake, thousands of people die, so it is a very significant event, which will certainly be true for the end of time. Now let's break down some of the specific things he says. First of all, how many people are killed? 7,000. Now, do you think that number is literal, or do you think the number is figurative? I would imagine that it has some symbolic significance. Right. There again, think about the numbers that we've talked about in the past. Seven, as Harvey mentioned, describes completeness, perfection, fullness. Well, that would make sense, because if we're dealing with the unrighteous at the end of time, will anybody be left out? God's going to get them all. So you've got seven, and then we've said what about the word thousand? Ten is also, we have ten fingers. Somebody says, I have ten fingers, I have ten toes. You have them all? Yeah. So we have completeness expressed by 10. And then we've said before, when you begin to multiply that number by 10, somebody says, this is not only good, this is really, really good. When we begin to add things, add numbers in the sense of 10, and we begin to add descriptions, things like adjectives, we are amplifying the point. So when you take 10, that number of completeness, and when you begin to multiply it out, what does that do with the completeness? You not only have three stars, you've got four stars, and then you have five stars. You just keep adding. So when John says 7,000 persons, not a literal number, but that number seems to be a number which describes complete totality. Every single person that needs to be punished, and I think here specifically in the context, we're talking about punishment because they oppose God and the work of his people in the church. Every single person that deserves to be punished will be punished. And you can see the reason for that. As you go back to, in the chapter, verses 7 through 9, let's reread those verses again. When they shall have finished their testimony, the beast that cometh up out of the abyss shall make war with them and overcome them and kill them. And their dead bodies lie in the street of the great city, which is spiritually called Sodom in Egypt, where also the Lord was crucified. And from among the peoples and tribes and tongues and nations do men look upon their dead bodies 3 days and a half, and suffer not their dead bodies to be laid in a tomb. And they that dwell in the earth rejoice over them and make merry. And they shall send gifts one to another, because these two prophets, that is, God's people, Christians, tormented them that dwell on the earth. When people behave in that kind of way, they deserve to be punished? Yeah. And God says, if you were part of this particular group, you are going to face my wrath.
They're like dancing on the grave.
Yes, that's exactly right. You know, just as you would see sometimes, soldiers have been prosecuted for that in places like Iraq. They would dance over the graves of the enemies, spit on the deceased and so forth. And here you have absolute contempt for God's people. And God says a day of reckoning is going to come and people are going to pay for that. Now, there are a couple of things that are a little difficult about verse 13 in Revelation 11. I think we can understand the great earthquake, the imagery there, and the 7,000 and so forth. But you also have towards the end of the verse a reference to the people who were affrighted. Now, who are these people? In 7 and 9?
Yeah.
Okay.
Now, is that talking about, so those who were persecuting the church thought that they had stamped the church out, right?
Yes.
They thought it was gone.
Yes.
But then it's revived.
Right. Verse 11 says they came back.
Okay.
Yeah. So you have there, I think, a couple things going on. There were some people that were literally killed as you look throughout the Christian era. And then spiritually, you also, I think, have to see that, because if the church has died, as far as the truth, they've always had some kind of religion throughout time. But true religion has not always been something that has been easy to find.
But through all this too, Christians are still trying to convert those.
You have that going on throughout the Christian era, and there have been some times where, you know, we mentioned the Dark Ages last week, periods like that were especially difficult. You know, they didn't have the study tools like we have today, even copies of the Bible were not available. So very, very difficult for a lot of folks, and things did look really dim for a long period of time.
So they were still trying to convert, though, right?
The people that had a knowledge of the truth, I think it probably was very difficult. It'd be like somebody today that's on the run from the FBI trying to get new ID. How are you going to do that? You just can't, put an ad out on Craigslist or eBay and say, I'm looking for a new ID, but covertly. You're out there trying to make some contacts, and I think Christians probably were trying to do that same kind of thing. They couldn't openly preach, they couldn't openly meet, but still trying to do the best that they could, working within their circumstances. So just a very, very difficult time. Okay, let's talk about these people who were affrighted. In my mind, we have to identify them as one of two groups. They could describe the righteous. Now, if this is true, it's going to be an interesting thought when that hour, John says, comes. Maybe as God's people look at what's going to happen to the persecutors, they're going to kind of step back a little bit and say, wow, here's what my enemies are going to face. Remember how Jesus described it in Matthew 13, I think it's verse 42. The unrighteous are going to be sent to a furnace of fire. Now you see somebody go into that kind of environment, being told, depart from me, from the living God. That might cause some Christians to kind of step back and think twice. So it could be that as John describes the affrighted people here, he's talking about the reaction of God's people as they see what's going to happen. I don't know that Christians are going to be jumping up and down for joy because of what's going to happen to the unsaved, but certainly it would seem to be something that's going to leave an impression on people. If the affrighted do not describe the saved, then the only other people that I could associate with the group would be the unsaved. And the unsaved, there certainly, I think, is going to be fright on their part when they come face to face with God. We think what James said about James 2, verse 19, do the demons believe in God? They believe, and James said they also tremble, they shudder. So it's a terrifying thing. So certainly for the unsaved, I think there's got to be a sense in which they're going to finally acknowledge God's greatness, the fact that his plan was successful, and they're not going to have any doubt about his existence and power. In Romans 14, verse 11, Paul said every knee is going to acknowledge that, Christ is Lord. So even if people don't want to do that, they will, at the end of time, come to this conclusion and make this acknowledgement. Trace?
Well, in 9-11, look how many people praised God and turned to God for a very short time, but that they let it go again.
Yeah. And they weren't face to face with the Almighty. I mean, when you're standing toe to toe with him, if you will, figuratively speaking, it's, I think even for the righteous, it's probably going to be a little bit overwhelming. You think about John in the first chapter. He sees the vision of Jesus and he falls down. He's a righteous man. He falls down as one dead. So coming into the presence of God, seeing what happens to God's enemies at the end of time, a very, very terrifying thing. I do want to say a couple things about the 10th part of the city as well, but we'll see if there's anything that you want to add or ask before we get to this part of the verse.
Okay, they are afraid and they give glory to God in heaven, but that still doesn't mean that still means that they will be destroyed, right?
If the affrighted refers to non-Christians, yes. You sometimes have people today, they will acknowledge the greatness of somebody. It might be, if you think of it in terms of an execution, somebody finally says, you got me. I don't like the fact that you got me. I don't like the fact that you're going to execute me. But finally, I acknowledge the power of the state. And, you know, coming face to face with God, even the demons, they're opposed to God. And the fact that they tremble, I think, would be in that same category. They acknowledge it, even though they don't like it.
A lot of times when there's a disaster, it's when people turn and look to God. But after a certain period of time, it kind of fades away again. It just holds.
Yeah.
But people think in their mind, well, there is a God at that time. So I think a lot of times that's what happens.
Yeah. Here, it's one thing to hear about something. It's one thing to read about something, but actually to experience something, that's generally when people say, it's always going to stay with me. And for the unsaved, I am pretty convinced that when they come face to face with God, that's going to be something that stays with them for eternity. To be there in the presence of someone or something that is that holy, that pure, and they see their own sinfulness, there is nothing there. They had no contact with the benefits of Christ's blood. And when they see that, it's just going to be so overwhelming. They see the point as far as where they are spiritually, what has to be done. But once again, we're going to have the word wrath that's used in about verse 18. And some people are going to be angry about it. But it's like people today. They're angry that they got caught. Maybe not angry that they didn't avoid the action that led to that. But still, they're angry and they now have to face the consequence. I'll take your hand, Bonnie, after I think it was Steve.
Well, we'll go back to Matthew. Mm-hmm. Those with him who regarded Jesus saw the earthquake and the things that happened. They feared greatly, saying, truly, this was the Son of God.
All right. That would be a good cross-reference. As far as you have the reaction of a man, he comes face-to-face with this divine act, if you will, and he draws that conclusion. He kind of steps back and says, wow. But how greater that's going to be when people actually stand face-to-face with God. So, thoughtful reference. Thank you, Bunny.
Well, the affrighted, could that mean that they repented?
Well, if they repented, it wouldn't be repentance in the sense of saving repentance, which we have access to now. Because once again, this is taking us to the end of time. And we're going to deal with this a little bit later. Luke 13, the door is at that point shut. There's no hope. But you probably have a lot of people, or will have a lot of people on that day thinking, well, God, just give me one more chance. My heart was good, and I had stuff going on with the kids and the family, and we're really sorry. But, don't we have cases today where people are in a position where they get to a set of circumstances, they see that they've lost the opportunity, and they are so sorry, they say, give me another shot. Can you think of some examples? People have blown it. They know they've blown it. And they're sorry. They say, just give me one more chance and I'll make it right. All right, it could be that you have a job situation and a person has said, this mistake has been done this number of times. If it happens again, you're done. And maybe later that day, within a week, month, year, whatever it is, it happens again and they mess it up. What about the three strikes and you're out law? You think about a person who has been convicted three times of something, or at least charged three times, and then the fourth. You think with that fourth criminal charge, they feel bad? I think a lot of them do. Just give me one more shot. I'm so sorry. I know I shouldn't have done it. But once again, the door shut. Opportunity is lost. Okay, let's say a few things about the 10th part of the city. John does not describe this city that fell. But when we think about cities in the book of Revelation, we do have a reference to a place called Babylon, We'll see that beginning in Revelation 14. It's also used in Revelation 16 and then a couple of times in Revelation 18. Different ideas exist about Babylon in my mind, and we'll study this a little bit more fully as we go through. It seems that John probably uses Babylon to describe human religious practices. We talk about sometimes Matthew 15, 8 and 9, the doctrines and the precepts of men. Well, that's been around for a long time throughout the Christian era. We certainly have it today when we think about denominationalism. On the day of judgment, what's going to happen to those practices? The people who are involved with them. If Christ and his church are structured this way, but people headed off with a quote-unquote religion that was headed this way, how well are they going to fare? They're not going to fare very well. Remember Matthew 7, 22 and 23? Jesus said, many will on that day, Lord, Lord, did we not? And he's going to go through the list. And the Lord will say, depart from me, I never knew you. How come? Because you were off there in Babylon. You had these religious practices that were contrary to the truth. As far as the number 10, he says the 10th part of a city fell. Now, if we were looking at this in literal terms, we would say, well, okay, how big was the city? What's a tenth? But we've said John repeatedly uses symbolic language in this book. So 10, remember going back to 10 fingers and 10 toes? A tenth part of the city, 10 symbolizes completeness, perfection, fullness. So when he says a tenth part of the city, symbolically that would tell us he's talking about the whole thing. So it's very, very helpful to remember, especially as we study about numbers, that usually we have symbolic information associated with them. And then we have the other thing, a great earthquake. Out of all the images that John could have pictured to describe a terrible event that's going to destroy spiritually the lives of people, he could have said a hurricane, he could have said a tsunami, various things, but an earthquake is one that most people can understand. So it was a great, great image to say when the end comes, if you're on the wrong side of the fence, it's going to be a very, very bad experience for you, especially if you're involved in persecuting God's people. The Lord doesn't respond well to that. Remember Acts, I think it was Acts 9, you have two accounts of Saul's conversion, but the Lord shows up to Saul on the Damascus Road and says, Saul, Saul, why persecutest thou who?
Me.
He was actually persecuting the church. So when we think about the persecutors of God's church, it is a very, very serious matter. Anything that you want to add or ask before we pick up with verse 14 and following? Molly?
They destroyed so many. Why were there some left then? What was the purpose of that? You know, remnants?
Okay.
Why were they, if they destroyed with the earthquake so many unchristians, non-Christians, why were these left?
Okay. If we look at verse 13 as describing the end of time, John uses that image of an earthquake to describe the disaster that's going to come upon the unsaved, their fate, their consequence. And he says, as we look in the middle of that, there were killed in the earthquake 7,000 persons, and the rest were affrighted. And that's why I said the rest. It becomes a little difficult to identify who those people were. One possible explanation would be that they were, the word rest just refers to the saved. If that's true, then the 7,000 that were killed, the number 7, plus that multiple of 10 to get us to 1,000, would describe all the unsaved. Then the rest, who were affrighted, may refer to Christians. When they saw what was taking place with the unsaved, they kind of stepped back and said, wow. If that's not the right explanation, then you have to understand the rest as the only other people that would exist. And those would be the unsaved. That explanation to me is a little difficult because, as you pointed out, you have to then make a distinction between these people. They were scared, they were affrighted, if you will, but they're not listed with the people who were killed. So it seems to me to look at the text in the best way is saying two groups of people. The 7,000 refers to all the unrighteous, and especially in that group you'd have the people who persecuted the church, but all the unsaved. And then the rest, God's people, they saw what was taking place, and it was something that frightened them. And that's why I mentioned Revelation chapter 1. If John, a righteous man, was scared by what he saw, can you imagine you are not only coming into God's presence, like John did, but now you're actually seeing what God does with the unsaved at the end of time?
Well, I reckon I would
And like I say, that is an explanation. It's just a little difficult to see why they wouldn't be classed with the people who were killed. So like I say, I favor that first explanation, but it is possible to go ahead and understand it in the other way too. Okay. A few things about verse 14, and then we'll pick up with 15 to 17 and spend a little more time there. The second woe was past. Behold, the third woe cometh quickly. Now back in Revelation chapter 8, verse 13, John described an eagle and said that this eagle was flying mid-heaven. And it was beginning with that verse that he describes these three woes. That would be trumpets 5, 6, and 7. Now at this point, he's gone through trumpets 5. He's about through trumpet 6. And that would tell us that he's now about ready for the seventh trumpet. And as we said, the seventh trumpet is going to take us to events related to what happens after the Lord returns. Okay, let's then pick up with 15 through 17. And the seventh angel, here it is, you've got trumpet 7 now sounding. And there followed great voices in heaven. And they said, "The kingdom of the world has become the kingdom of our Lord and of his Christ, and he shall reign forever and ever. And the 24 elders who sit before God on their thrones fell upon their faces and worshiped God, saying, We give thee thanks, O Lord God, the Almighty, who art and who was, because thou hast taken thy great power and didst reign. And the nations were wroth, and thy wrath came, and the time of the dead to be judged, and the time to give their reward to thy servants, the prophets, and to the saints, and to them that fear thy name, the small and the great, and to destroy them that destroy the earth." As we said, seventh seal, the seventh trumpet, and the seventh plague all take us to events related to what's going to take place when the Lord returns. And now John has brought us to the point where we've got trumpet number 7 being blown. And he says, if you look back a little bit, remember Revelation chapter 10, verse 6, that was where we had the angel. He's got a foot on the land, he's got a foot on the sea, and he reads, he has this little book in his hands. And then in verse 6 it says, "And swear by him that liveth forever and ever, who created the heavens and the earth that are in." And then he says, "There shall be a delay no longer." Well, that's what we're dealing with here, the delay that has taken place throughout the Christian era. God is still delaying for whatever reason. We think, as we've suggested in previous classes, that's to let all the people who want to become Christians get saved. But the delay that's taking place right now, in Revelation 11, 15 through 17, it has finally ceased. Now, this was a point that Jesus talked about at various times as well. I mentioned a few minutes ago a passage from the book of Luke, Luke chapter 13, verse 25. I'm going to slip back over there and read that. Verse 22 tells us Jesus was on his way through cities, villages. He was teaching, heading towards Jerusalem. In verse 23, he was asked if only few people would be saved. And he said unto them, in verse 24, "Strive to enter in by the narrow gate. For many, I say unto you, shall seek to enter in and shall not be able." And then he says this in verse 25, "When the master of the house is risen up." And what's he done with the door? He shut it. Well, that's going to happen. There's going to come a time when the Christian era is going to cease, and God is going to, if you will, shut the door to salvation. And John's going to talk about this also in Revelation chapter 11, verse 18, a little bit later in the chapter. So that's kind of the big point that we're dealing with here. 13:25. Now, if you followed along closely, especially if you had the King James translation, you may see that your translation read a little differently than mine. The middle of the verse, if you have some translations that we use the word kingdom, if you have some other translations, you'll find that the word is plural. It is kingdoms. And there's a reason for that. As with most cases, when you have this kind of variation, there's a manuscript variation. So some of our manuscripts say kingdom, some of our manuscripts say kingdoms, plural. And if John intended to use the word singular, if that's the right idea, then the focus would seem to be on the kingdom that he talked about, or the church, mentioned in Revelation chapter 1, verse 9. And that would mean, when the end comes, looking at what he says here, Christ is going to be one. He's going to be in complete harmony, full harmony, if you will, with his people, with the members of his kingdom. As you look down a little bit in the chapter, Revelation 11, verse 19, that last verse, "And there was opened the temple of God that's in heaven. And there was seen in the temple the ark of his covenant. And there followed lightnings and voices and thunders and an earthquake and great hail." So kingdom is the idea. At the end of time, God finally says to his people what? Come. just as Jesus described in Matthew 25, come ye blessed of my Father, inherit the kingdom prepared for you from the foundation of the world. Everything is ready, and now it's time for us to be fully joined. If this explanation is right, then in verse 15 he says, the seventh angel sounded, and there followed great voices in heaven. Well, if we're dealing with the end of time, God's people have fully been brought to him in the kingdom, singular, if it is singular, then you have these voices in heaven. Those voices would seem to include the people who are saved, plus angelic voices, whatever other creatures God has there. So you would seem to have, if kingdom is the idea, when everything gets wrapped up, all the saved are together, all the righteous are together, the good angels and so forth, there's going to be a great heavenly chorus because God's plan for salvation, God's plan for redemption has been finished. Now, if John intended to use the plural, kingdoms, then another point would be what he was trying to stress, and that would be the point that you have in 1 Corinthians 15, verses 24 through 26. Remember, in those verses, Paul said the end's going to come, Christ is going to deliver up the kingdom to God the Father, and those powers, those forces on the earth, what's going to happen to them? They're all going to be subjected or brought into submission to whom? To God or Christ. Everything is going to be, even Satan, who's very active now, everything that's in opposition to Jesus is going to be brought under his control. Everything will be relinquished, and it will be shown that he is the ruler over all things. So both things are true, but whether John used the singular or the plural, there's simply no way to affirm that. We do know, as we look at verse 18, that some people are not going to be happy about it. He says, and the nations were angry. The ASV uses the word wrath. When the day of judgment comes, and I would suspect that people who are in the Hadean realm right now and not in a relationship with God are probably not real happy. You think about the rich man in Luke 16, how he's suffering. He can't be in a state of pleasure. But especially at the end of time when people are brought before God and they see what their fate is going to be, they'll realize that Jesus is Lord of all and they have no hope. You also have in these verses, backing up a little bit to verse 15, Jesus is going to reign how long? Forever and ever. And I'll give you a couple quotes here that I think are good. One source said that means the state is going to prevail until some expressed or implied conditions of a covenant are satisfied. Thus, Christ's reign over his kingdom will last forever in the sense that it will endure. As long as the entity exists on earth, it will end only when the covenant and state of affairs which have allowed it to exist on earth have brought to their consummation. And that's right. Jesus is the head of the church. He's ruling right now in his kingdom. But in 1 Corinthians 15, Paul said that he was going to deliver up the kingdom at the appropriate time. A few more things to say. Anything that you want to add or ask before we pick up with these additional items? Okay, we've seen some information about the 24 elders back in Revelation chapter 4, verse 4. We don't know for sure if the elders mentioned back there are the same 24 elders mentioned here. I think there's at least a good chance for that as far as the two groups being the same. And if you will think back, I know it's been a long time, but anybody recall what we said about those 24 elders, what they represent? Probably not 24 literal people, but 24 elders may symbolize the saved, the righteous. Under the Old Testament, how many tribes did we have? 12. Under the New Testament with the apostles, Jesus picked 12 apostles. So 12 plus 12 is 24. And it was just another symbol, another way of saying that all the saved are going to be together in eternity. All right, then as you look at these 24 elders, what's said about them? They're mentioned in verse 16. They sit before God on the thrones. They fall upon their faces. They worship God. And then in verse 17, the beginning of the verse, they say what? We give thanks. Well, that's interesting. What would they be thankful for? You think about all the people in eternity. Especially, I mean, you've got angelic creatures. I think they're probably grateful that sinful man has been redeemed. But why would people be thankful? God, we thank you. Why? What's God done for? All right, he's taken care. He's brought his saints home. He's forgiven them of his sins. He has redeemed his people. So when we think about those, primarily focused on the people in the church right now, as we study the book of Revelation, they're going to be very, very grateful for the redemption that has come through Christ. As I was looking at this a couple weeks ago, I came across what I thought was kind of a neat story. There was an old Indian chief. He was converted, heard the truth, and obeyed it. And somebody said, well, you know, kind of explain this conversion you've had, chief. So the chief said, okay, come sit down. And he took some leaves, piled them up, and then put a worm in the middle of the leaf pile. And then he set the outer edge of the leaves on fire. And those leaves began to burn, and the flames got closer and closer to the worm. And just before the flames consumed the worm, the old chief grabbed that worm and plucked it out and said, me, worm. And I thought, that's a pretty good illustration of redemption. You know, here we are, the flames were getting closer and closer. We were going to be, consumed by sin. We were going to die by sin. But God reached down and at great cost to himself, plucked us out and gave us freedom. Now, there's another thing that you may have noticed as we went through the text. This is especially visible with the King James. The King James talks about Jesus as being the one who was and is. But you'll also see another point there. The Lord is also described as the one who is to come. Now, if what we've said is correct as far as John is describing the end of time, the Lord has come. People are there before his throne. You've got the righteous giving thanks for the redemption which has taken place. You've got the unsaved. They're going to receive their punishment. Would that be true? The Lord is going to come? Hasn't he already come? He was. He is. Yeah, he's already come the second time. So that point in the King James, again, because of a variant, I do not think that that is correct. The sixth trumpet, as we said, brings us up to the time of the Lord's return. And then with the seventh, which John has introduced, we talked about the seventh trumpet, verse 15. And now the Lord has returned. So with the King James translation, that does confuse the thought just a little bit. All right. A couple other quick points here, and then we'll pick up with the information in verses 18 and 19. People have a lot of different ideas about heaven. My sister right now is still going through some difficult things. The brain is still not quite right. And I'll probably never be able to say this to her or to the family. But she's had some images in her mind of dad playing with the baby and, you know, out playing with the dog and some other things. When you talk to people, they have some of those images which I would relate to things that we would enjoy on the earth. You know, grandparent with a grandchild and people out playing in the backyard with a dog. They have a lot of those earthly images. But when you begin to look at the book of Revelation, is that the picture that you see? Out in the backyard, digging up flowers and playing with Rover?
No.
No. What's the picture? Worship, honor, glorifying God, and giving thanks to God for the redemption of man. So people do have some medical issues sometimes where they dream some strange things and experience some weird things. But when I'm asked about these kinds of things, my point is I can tell you what the Bible says. We don't have a lot of information, but the information in the scriptures that talks about what heaven is like, it is completely unlike the things that we relate to this earth. It is a spiritual environment. People are focused on spiritual things, and I believe that you experience something, but I also know what the Bible teaches, and this is, if you're thinking about going to heaven, this is what you need to expect. Anything that you want to add or ask before we pick up with verses 18 and 19? Okay. Finishing off the chapter, and then we'll try to introduce Revelation 12 next week. He says in verse 18, which we read, and the nations were wroth, and thy wrath came, and the time of the dead to be judged, and the time to give the reward to thy servants, the prophets, and to the saints, and to them that fear thy name, the small and the great, and to destroy them that destroy the earth. And there was opened the temple of God that is in heaven, and there was seen in his temple the ark of his covenant, and there followed lightnings and voices and thunders and an earthquake and great hail. Now when we have a reference to the dead, and John says the dead are being what?
Judged.
Well, that naturally would take us to where? As far as biblical information in the New Testament. When are the dead going to be judged? All right, the end of time. So this is one more reason to believe that as we come to the seventh seal, we are dealing with events related to the end of time. And then we also have, in addition to the dead being judged, what else does John say? The time has also come to give a reward. Reward to whom? All right, we've got servants, some of whom were prophets, And then we've also got some who were saints, and then we've got others who were people who feared God's name. And then John says, even the small and the great. And then at the end of verse 18, he talks about dealing with those, punishing those that destroy the earth. As you look at verse 18, it really would be parallel to what Jesus described in Matthew 25, verses 31 through 33. The Lord pictures himself at the end of time on a throne. And he says, there are going to be those on my right, they're going to be like the sheep or goats?
Sheep.
And then there are going to be those on my left that are like the goats, and they're going to be dealt with appropriately. Now, in verse 18, John offers a distinction, if you will, between saved people. We pointed it out, but let's look at it once again. He says, time for the dead to be judged, and there's going to be a reward given to the people that are entitled to it. And then that reward is associated with the prophets and saints, to those that fear God's name, and then to the small and the great. Anybody want to take a stab at why John may have mentioned different groups in talking about the reward that's going to be given to the saved at the end of time?
They were the ones who were being persecuted.
All right. So we do have the saved, and maybe the reward is going to be based on what people face. Not everybody faced persecution or persecution to the extent that some did in the first century and throughout time. Not everybody's going to be martyred for the faith. So persecution could be one of the things that's factored in there. Any other ideas? Why specify different groups among the saved?
Because it shows that every group.
All right. I think you could make maybe a point about that as well. Every group. It could be that we're talking about, you know, people that lived prior to Moses' law. For example, we've got Abel. He was a righteous person before the law. We have people under Moses' law that were certainly righteous. And throughout the Christian era, we've got some people there. So that distinction could be made as well. Anything else?
Great.
Betty, was that you or Glenda? Okay.
I was saying what you said, Old and New Testament.
Okay. Different time periods?
I think it was Cain.
Another idea here, and I don't know that I'd use this really to support this, but one of the things that I wonder about a little bit, people sometimes ask, is everybody going to receive the same reward? I think there's some indications where the Bible suggests that the reward is not going to be equal for everybody. And this passage may be an indication of that. You've got people who serve as a prophet. You have people who served as an apostle. I don't know that Christians, you know, would have any right to expect to receive what the apostles received. When you go back and you look at what they gave up, what they experienced, they are presented in some fairly distinct ways in the New Testament. So John definitely does make some distinctions here, but all certainly are going to find heaven to be a very, very wonderful place. Then tied into this too, think about what Jesus said, I guess, in Matthew 6, verses 19 through 21. He said, lay up for yourselves treasure where? In heaven. If we were to say, hey, lay up some money for retirement, you think everybody would lay up the same amount of money? No. And if that parallel is accurate with Matthew 6, verses 19 through 21, then people will not have laid up the same amount of treasure. There will be some distinctions. So, like I say, John does draw some distinction here, but exactly what he had in mind with it, I'm not quite sure. Then, of course, we have a reference to the nations. Who do you think the nations are? Good folks or bad folks? Well, what else does he say about the nations? The nations were
angry.
Well, you think people going to heaven are going to be angry? Probably not. So the nations here would describe good folks or bad folks? Bad folks. The word nations would describe the unsaved. They're going to stand in contrast to God's servants, some of whom, as we said, were the prophets, the saints, and those who reverence God's name. When you look at the Old Testament, you need to be careful here. John says the people who feared God's name. Some, I think, may look at this and say, well, hey, I feared God's name. I wasn't obedient, but I feared him. Is that going to be enough to get us in? No. Fear is a way of saying you were willing to be obedient. So, Old Testament, uses this expression in a variety of places. Deuteronomy 6, verse 13, also 34, Psalm 34, verse 9. So it's not a way of describing the disobedient. It's a way of describing those who really wanted to seek God and do His will. Then you have a reference here also to the people who destroyed the earth. And there is, in the original text, a play on words. Destroy can mean destroy completely, as well as destroy morally. And John seems to have both ideas in play here as he describes this. When you think about the unsaved, would you say, is it fair to say that they destroy the earth? And we've just talked about from Revelation 11 some folks that are bent on destroying the church. All right, you have that. Okay, you have that. What about the Bible? If you could suck the Bible and Christianity out of the world, would there be a vacuum? Would there be a void? Yeah. When you begin to strip away that foundation for morality, what have you done? You leave a vacuum that's filled with hate, violence, every form of unrighteousness. So the people who are trying to tear down spiritual things, and we see that in abundance right now, what are they also building up? Evil. Based on what we have here in Revelation chapter 11, does God take notice of that? Yes. And he says, if you have tried to corrupt the world by destroying my work, you're going to pay. A time is going to come where you are going to experience some really, really bad things. So that's going to be a fate of the unsaved. All right, when the unsaved, as we mentioned from verse 18, see that they have no hope for eternity, they're not going to be happy, they're going to be wroth. And this passage would tell us that the idea of universal salvation, everybody is going to be saved, that's simply not true. John affirms that some people will be angry. When you think about people, anger comes in a lot of different forms, a lot of different levels, but on the day of judgment, I suspect that people are going to be as angry as they have ever been. Then we have some information in verse 19 about the temple of God. This, of course, would describe heaven as we think of it. It's going to be the eternal dwelling place for the saved. We also saw this described back in Revelation chapter 4. And then John here describes the ark. And it doesn't say the ark of the covenant. He says the ark of his covenant, which is an interesting description. Maybe that's designed to point us to the idea that this is going to be something that's very special, very unique. When you think about the Old Testament ark, it was something that the Hebrews were not able to see. You've got the priest just seeing that in the Holy of Holies, and it was the place where people met God. By God saying, you know, you're going to be brought to this place where, you know, my ark is, that would be suggestive of God saying, you now have what kind of relationship with me? We're now one. You're now as close to me as you possibly can be throughout eternity. There's no way to get any closer. My plan to redeem man has come to a conclusion. You now have the inheritance, 1 Peter chapter 1, verse 4, that was promised to you. Then you have, quickly, the lightnings, the voices, the thunders, the earthquake, the great hail, all additional things. And as you look at the seven seals, and as you look at the seven plagues, when you deal with the seventh of these items, you have these same imageries. You have the same imagery. Imagery, I think, designed to say, hey, you're now in the presence of God. You're now going to see what it's like for the unrighteous. Time has actually ended. So there are a couple of the references there that we could have run to show that when we do come to the seventh of these three items, the plagues, the trumpets, the seals, we are dealing with the end. But that's really where John brings us to.